We have now the last talk of this conference by Kelly Stern, Imperial College, and he will talk about brain safety and some cosmology.
Okay, so it's a pleasure to be back here at the Perimeter Institute. It's been a number of years since I've been back here. We had a pandemic in the meantime, but it's great to see everybody back together. I'm not going to try to give a rapporteur talk on the whole conference, but I'm basically going to talk about some things that are buzzing around in my head and occasionally make some side comments about things that I've been hearing, we've all been hearing this week. So let me just begin with this picture that Astrid gave us. I don't really want to insist on this, but it maybe sets a theme about some ways that we could learn perhaps to talk to each other. And that I think is also one of the themes of this conference, is just to get different communities to communicate a bit more. I don't insist that this scheme where there can be string theory at ultimately high energies morphing into an effective theory of asymptotically safe gravity, but it at least establishes a framework for some of the things that I want to talk about. So this basically are some of the themes I'll mention. Whether we could live on a brain, that's really a string theory type topic. Then the consequences of safe gravity for the early universe, anisotropies and inhomogeneity, and then go on to the issue of complex metrics and the no boundary proposal, and finally whether cosmology can actually tell us some things about the parameter ranges of some of the effective theory constructions that we make. So let's come to the first topic of whether we could live on a brain. So string theory, of course, invites a higher dimensional perspective, and we have to find some way of living in a lower dimensional part of that original higher dimensional space-time. Now, a standard picture of how to do this involves compactification of the extra dimensions. But there could be other possibilities suggested by the brain solutions of supergravity effective theory. So for the standard picture, here we have a picture of a viewpoint of compactification that I got from a Yayoi Kusama exhibition, in fact, in Jerusalem. But that's not actually what I want to talk about now. This is sort of the compactification viewpoint on spheres, for example. But there are other ways you could anticipate this to happen. So string effective field theories involve a metric, anti-symmetric tensors, and various and spinners and scalars. Now, brain solutions carry electric or magnetic type charges from these various form fields. And if we study the fluctuations around some such brains, you can have a brain world effective theory that behaves like a lower dimensional system. So this is what I would call gravity localization as opposed to compactification. So if you have a system where there's genuinely a non-compact transverse space, well, one thing that you can do in such situations is actually make a consistent reduction or consistent embedding of physics on the lower dimensional space-time into the higher dimensional space. But this is like standard Kaluza-Klein dimensional reduction, but with a non-compact transverse space. Basically, you're smearing out the dependence in the transverse directions. but there's another possibility which occurs in a couple of situations. One of these is starts with the 1984 Salam-Sezgin theory, which I want to talk about a bit. So I don't have time to go into this in detail, but let me just remind you, if you knew about it, the Salam-Sezgin theory started in six dimensions. It's a supersymmetric theory involving a 1,0 supergravity theory coupled to a tensor multiplet and a Maxwell multiplet. It has one outstanding feature here, which is this last term, there's a potential, which is, however, because it's in the action, has a minus sign in front, it's a positive potential. That's the standout feature of the Salam-Sezgin theory. And it allows certain things to happen when you dimensionally reduce further from 6 down to 4 on a sphere. Normally, a sphere reduction would give you an anti-de Sitter space in the lower dimension, but if you start with this positive potential, they can cancel out, and you have a solution with a very nice flat four-dimensional space-time as the lower dimensional world. This theory can also be embedded into supergravities in 10 dimensions. In fact, it embeds nicely into type 1 supergravity already. And if you write it up there in the 10-dimensional perspective, this is the way it looks. So the vacuum solution with this flat four-dimensional world volume fits nicely into 10 dimensions like that. involves various, all sorts of nice things one can talk about. There's a Noguchi-Hansen metric as part of it. But let me just give you that as a starting point. So as I've said, there is an embedding, in fact, of n=2 four-dimensional supergravity on this lower dimensional space, but that's not what I want to focus on now. There's another possibility. So let me just remind you that this is non-compact. Overall, it has this kind of hyperbolic structure as you go out to infinity. It doesn't go become 10-dimensional asymptotically flat. It goes asymptotically hyperbolic. Actually, it's an H22 space. But let's look at the possibilities that we have. Sorry, this got moved. But if you use separation of variables to study the fluctuations, so into functions of the x's are the world volume, that's the four-dimensional world volume, and the transverse coordinates, well, I call them generally y, but actually we're going to look at situations where there's only one important transverse coordinate, which is a kind of a radius. So we can make a separation of variables of h mu nu of x times xi of rho, and then we study the effective field equation for this transverse wave function and see what happens. And this probably did happen because we shifted it into this. I don't like PowerPoint very much. Sorry about this. okay, so this transverse structure turns out to have a Poeschl-Teller integrable structure, which allows you to solve it. And you find a very interesting thing. There's a single zero mode, then a mass gap, and then and in a transverse space, you expect a continuum. You get it, but you get it after a mass gap. This is what allows the perspective of an effective theory in the lower dimension. So the zero mode is normalizable, and in fact, I normalized it. I'm sorry about how it happened to the slides. you also get a finite Newton constant given here, and you can do all the integrals because of this integrability structure, and you actually get an effective theory of massless spin 2. Yeah, see if the PDF works better. Hey, I have to say about Mr. Gates, I think it's great that he gives away his money to useful causes, but I often don't like his software. But that's better. Yes, thank you. Okay, so that's basically the structure. So this involves a different type of boundary condition as you approach this world volume, which is what's called a Robin boundary condition. It's a mixed Dirichlet-Norman type of boundary condition. Given a second-order differential equation, you have two options. You have two basic solutions. The standard one is sort of this Dirichlet consistent embedding possibility that is perfectly well known from ordinary compactifications, but this is a non-compact setup. But there is the other solution, which actually naturally localizes gravity near the brain. Then in the longer talk, I could give you all sorts of other interesting features about this structure. Let me just say that this is not the only case where this happens. And there are analogous situations you can study, in fact, with the general study of singular Sturm-Liouville systems that started, in fact, with Hermann Weyl. And there's a very nice American Mathematical Society monograph by Zettel that describes all of this. And using that together with Rahim Lung, we found a number of other examples. I don't think this is exhausting, but this is what we know. Randall-Sundrum, which we heard from Lisa. We heard Randall-Sundrum 1 from Lisa yesterday. This is Randall-Sundrum 2, where you banish the one of the two brains. There are other examples of this. And so this is another possibility of not compactification, but localization of gravity in a lower dimension. So there's another possibility for effective theory phenomenology within an overall 10-dimensional or string theory context. Let me also mention, by the way, since Fernando's here, this is related to another piece of Canadian physics, which we should have Cliff Burgess here too, the supersymmetry and large extra dimensions program. And perhaps we can get Fernando, if he's still around, to talk about that. okay, topic two, safety. And this goes back to the whole issue of higher derivatives. I'm going to focus on asymptotic safety in the fashion of Max Niedermayer. I realize that's not the totally popular way that things are done here with fancy functional renormalization group and so forth. I actually asked Daniel Litim to brief me on his investigations, and he tells me that you can sing this song in functional renormalization group language as well. So I'm just going to give it here. We have Einstein theory with a cosmological constant, Weyl squared term and R squared. There's going to have to be an energy scale for the subtractions, that's called mu, and then you have dimensionless Newton and cosmological constants. Now, there's a ghost in this theory, and what I want to say about it is I don't want to talk about it, because thankfully Bob Holdham and John Donoghue have given us very, very illuminating discussions on why you don't have to lose too much sleep about it. So let me just go on now, and here are the couplings that are running. I have to say also, because you know, one of the nice things about these meetings is you have dinners, and so you get to talk to people like John, who says, well, yes, these are the renormalization group equations that relate back to Fradkin, Seitlin, Avramidi, and Barvinsky, but he's grumpy about some of the ways these standard scale-dependent beta functions are related to what he would call the physical beta functions, and that requires more discussion, more dinners, and so forth. But I'm just going to present the results that are now several back from the 1980s. And this does give rise to an asymptotic freedom situation. The quadratic curvature terms are asymptotically free. So this quantity sigma is, in fact, the renormalization, the coefficient, you see, of the Weyl squared term. That's the important one. That's the dangerous one because of the ghost. And the R squared is written in, involves a factor of sigma, but also its own coefficient omega. There are many things one could discuss about this and also about the tachyonic nature of the scalar that comes from the R squared. But let me focus, however, on another aspect of this. So there is an asymptotically free situation for the Weyl squared term, constant values of Newton's constant and the cosmological constant. And here's a picture that's stolen from Niedermeyer's paper. And of course, Roberto here has also been very much involved in these early calculations. And Danielle tells me that there's a paper that he has that's going to come out soon. Okay, now, there's another principle one can adjoin to this, the principle of finite Euclidean action, that a quantum amplitude, which is weighted by the action, will only give well-defined contributions if the action actually, the integrated action, of course, is finite. This is also a point of view that goes back to earlier papers by John Barrow and Tipler back in the 80s. And so we will demand that the time integral be convergent in the approach to t equals zero, where the volume of space-time vanishes, and also assume finite spatial volume. When you do that, you can start to learn some things. So let's try an example of an anisotropic metric. Look at Bianchi type 9. I'm not going to go into the details of this, but now these beta coefficients are controlling the anisotropy. If you set them to zero, you get back to the symmetric situation. You insert that ansatz into the action, and the Einstein-Hilbert action, just the R root G term, gives rise to this effective theory with kinetic terms and a potential, or the anisotropy potential. Now, when you include the quadratic terms, the story changes because there's more to be added here for R squared and Weyl squared. I don't have to go through the details here, but I'm just going to tell you the theme of what happens. So let's assume a BKL type dependence on time with powers. And then you analyze these various terms and look at the scaling properties of them. Now, you're interested in not having divergences as t goes to zero of the action. So, for example, you have a term like a dot squared dt in the Hilbert Einstein-Hilbert term, and the integrated quantity then goes like t to the 3s minus 1. So then, you see, you have this set of scaling powers. If you go through the various terms, this is the zoo of possibilities. Now, you don't want any of these things to blow up. That is to say, you don't want any negative powers of t. And that requirement can easily be satisfied where anisotropies blow up at the Big Bang. Okay, so these conditions emerge, and that's fine for Einstein-Hilbert. But we're talking about a situation with the higher derivatives. So if you include those into the story, you get another set of scaling behaviors and ask the question again. And you get a set of mutually exclusive conditions. So actually, you see, this is a situation where the quadratic gravity is actually telling you something about the possible approach to t equals zero. They filter out universes that start out anisotropically. You can go on and do the same thing for inhomogeneities. If you take the Lemaître-Tolman-Bondi metric, where the A coefficient now is a function of T and R, there's a function F, a function of R only, you go through a similar discussion here, and you find conflicting requirements for the S power. It has to be less than one, it has to be greater than one, and so again, you find that you're ruling out things that Roger Penrose said should be ruled out. By the way, this is the Weyl curvature hypothesis that is emerging from this effective theory, including the higher derivative terms. By the way, it also, if you get rid of the inhomogeneities, you learn that A is expanding with S greater than one, so in fact, there's also inflation that's coming out of this sort of discussion. Okay, next topic, about complex metrics. And in fact, there's also, there are various links to other talks in this conference. Bianca already told us something about this. Hawking, Hartle and Hawking, the no boundary proposal. Basically, what I'm going to tell you comes from a paper by Neil, Jean-Luc Lenners, and Feldbrugge. And so I'm going to tell you also how this links up to some recent work on the admissibility of path integral integration over complex metrics. So in the early universe, of course, we have a situation like this, sort of cartoon, where you reach a point where you have to face what the Big Bang looks like. Now, in order to bound it off in a non-singular way, you have to include a Euclidean geometry, that's the red part, and that is the no-boundary proposal, basically. So this comes back from 1983, Hartle and Hawking. The initial proposal was that the wave function of the universe should be calculated by a path integral defined by a sum over compact regular Euclidean metrics. So the wave function, e to the minus Euclidean action over h bar. There's a lot more that one can discuss about details of this, but I want to just focus on certain sort of thematic aspects. The definition of the no boundary was changed to momentum space and so forth, but let's not go into all of that here now. So you have a wave function involving, now, in fact, so if we have a scalar field involved as well, there'll be an integration over the A scale factor of Friedmann FRW metric and phi. And so the basic idea is that you start with a regular Euclidean path. And initially, you want to reach eventually something that looks like the universe that you recognize, where the metric and the scalar field are real. And so in order to do these calculations, one uses saddle point approximations when S over H bar much greater than one. And so the dominant geometries then are extrema of the action. Again, one can go through the details of path integral technology, but let me just say that what comes out of this is that what you find with the required boundary conditions, these metrics or space times are typically complex, what are called fuzzy instantons. So complex metrics are coming in. Now, Hawking and Hartle basically glued two things together. Their prototype instanton involved complex de Sitter space. And for them, there was no scalar field. It was just a cosmological constant. They took half of a four sphere and they glued it onto de Sitter space nicely at the equator with a two-dimensional space of times, imaginary part and real part, okay? There's this trajectory that looks like this. Now, that's just a proposal by two great people, sadly both of them now gone, and it's really a shame that we've lost so many important people in recent years. But you should probably be doing this rather by a path integral, and you're going to have to integrate somehow over complex metrics. Now, As soon as you start integrating over complex metrics, you run into some puzzles, which are outlined by Ed Witten in this 2021 paper, that there are complex versions of flat space that are zero action, but they're not just flat space. For example, you have wormhole type situations with zero actions. They would have the same likelihood as a classical evolution, and they would therefore be counted in the path integral to the same extent as the usual classical solutions, but you don't want them in there. So you need some way to exclude them from the path integral. Then the theory goes into more recent times, where this type of discussion has been considered by Luko and Sorkin, by Koncevich and Siegel, by Ed Witten himself, by Jean-Luc Lenners and Jonas Lenners and Quentin. And there's a proposal about when metrics are allowable in the evaluation of a path integral. The basic requirement is that there should be possible to define a generic quantum field theory on it. That is to say, the path integral should converge for all p-form actions. Now, in this way of discussing it, they are considering that the matter is real, but the metric is complex. So that obviously can be the beginning of a longer story, which I'll only mention a little bit of with involving the scalars. So their proposal is that a metric is allowable if generic quantum field theory can be defined on it, and that requires that the absolute value of the action, or the Euclidean action would be e to the minus s, be less than one in order for it not to diverge. Then that requires, including the form fields, f of, say, of rank p plus one, this real part of this quantity has to be positive. Now, this is including only spin less than or equal to ones, because those are the ones that have local covariant stress energy tensors. And Koncevich and Siegel go on and say that in this situation, you can actually extend the formal definitions of quantum field theory in order to work with complex metrics. So now what do you get from that? If you write the d-dimensional metric in a diagonal form with eigenvalues lambda I, then, for example, the requirement for if you have a mass term of a scalar, you require the real part of square root of g to be positive. And that gives you a condition on the sum of the arguments written as e to the I argument times a modulus. The sum of those arguments, times a half, have to be between minus pi over 2 and pi over 2. The square root is where they give the factor of a half there. And more generally, for any subset of the set of d dimensions, you must have the real part of the product of the lambda eigenvalues. This is for the general p-forms. You have to be able to put any p-form in there. Of course, they come in squared. But you could have p-forms with some value zero, some values non-zero, and so forth. So you get a whole bunch of conditions which, however, boil down to this. This the sum of the moduli, the absolute values of the arguments of the lambdas has to be less than pi. So that is the Koncevich and Siegel requirement for integrability. And then you see, now you start to, how about ordinary Minkowski space? Well, that lives, a Lorentzian metric lives on the boundary of that space. If you are worried about it being on the boundary, of course, you can regulate them with a epsilon factor. And then the epsilon positive corresponds to the standard Feynman I epsilon prescription, and vice versa for epsilon equal to zero, but you shouldn't allow yourself to cross epsilon equals zero. Stay on one side of the boundary. When you adopt this criterion, a good thing happens. You get rid of the pathological metrics that Ed Witten was worried about. So this is already starting to show some positive signs. Now, another thing that you should think about, however, is that scalars, particularly in the supergravity context, this metric in a lower dimension could just be part of a larger rattling out of the higher dimensions construction involving a lower dimensional metric, vectors, and scalars, and so forth. In the higher dimension, they're all parts of the metric, so you shouldn't just be focusing on the metric alone in a lower dimensional effective theory. In particular, you should worry about the scalars. So you also need a criterion for the scalar fields too. So allowing the scalars to also become complex, you end up with a bound here. And then of course also the vectors need to be considered. So this is not a finished story. This is still under development, but we can already say some things. Now, also there's conformal transformations that you need to make to get to Einstein frame. Now, if you have complex scalar fields, of course, as we've said, no boundary solutions generally involve require complex scalar fields, which will be related to a potential in this fashion for their imaginary parts. And then, if you go back to the previous slide, where you see the imaginary part of phi is limited by about, well, d is the dimension of space-time you're working in. and so that turns out to be about pi over 10. Then combining this with this relation to the potential, you see there's a condition on the potential that comes out in order for the allowability of this situation. So cosmology plus path integrals are starting to tell you things about limiting ranges of parameters and so forth that otherwise are just free numbers you write down on a piece of paper. So let's have a little example of this, how this can come out. So this is actually a paper that I wrote with Jean-Luc and Rahim Leung. Starting in 8 dimensions, okay, then, well, with a structure that's actually rather familiar to people than string theory, the art of the fourth is one of the alpha prime corrections. And and then there's the four form squared, which is intrinsic to string theories. This has been taken as a starting point by Sergei Ketov and by Otero and all as a kind of F of R version of cosmology. If the scalar that's equivalent to the R plus R to the fourth term, let's call it the scalaron, it gets an inflationary type potential from this, which of course is what Alexei Starobinsky exactly wanted in the four-dimensional R plus R squared. There's a flux for the four form, and the value of the flux, of course, it's quantized. You have a number of different types. Well, in fact, this is also a picture that we just saw earlier today. In fact, I guess in, was it Bianca's talk? Anyway, we just, no, maybe Fernando. Or, yes. So you have these various situations depending upon the potential. Now, one thing that has not previously been happening is the inclusion of form field flux in no boundary proposal discussions. Those tend to involve just the metric alone, but this is actually going to give us a possibility of turning on the flux too. So that's where we start with. Now, there are two steps here in order to write it in a standard form. You want to rewrite it as gravity plus a scalar in the Einstein frame. So there's a standard set of steps here with involving scalar transformations. And then that is still in 8 dimensions, because that's where we're starting, and then you have to dimensionally reduce down to 4 on, for example, a 4 sphere. Okay, so that's the setup. That gives rise to a 4-dimensional theory of gravity coupled to 2 canonically normalized scalar fields and a potential. It looks like this. Here's the potential. It depends, as I've said, crucially on the amount of the flux of the four field. And indeed, Fernando was talking to us earlier about the importance of fluxes for moduli stabilization. So this is one of the things that I find rather neat. These are numerical calculations done by Jean-Luc. And so this is in terms of the complex time. So the horizontal axis is Euclidean time. The vertical axis is Lorentzian time, and you have both in this situation. You have a complex time. The south pole is this corner over here, 0 Euclidean, 0 Lorentzian time. And what the colors here is actually a shading where darker colors indicate smaller imaginary values. So actually what emerges is black lines are in fact the locus of where the fields are actually becoming real. You want eventually to come into a space-time which you think you recognize what you're seeing. so in fact, what happens here, this is the scale factor, the imaginary part of A, and here's the imaginary part of the scalar, both of them constrained, as I've said. And you see that eventually they're settling down to a nice real value here involving just the Lorentzian time. So this red point here can be considered the place where finally the original of real time, ordinary real time, has been achieved. And I've written also on here, this line is the Hartle-Hawking trajectory that we had on an earlier sphere, where they just glued together the half the photosphere with the Euclideanized de Sitter. So you approach final values given here at a certain time, real plus imaginary. And so this is an emergence of real time out of this sort of quantum gravity approach to the no boundary proposal. So that's the sense in which, and there are lots of other examples too that I could give you, where the no boundary proposal plus this sort of treatment of path integrals involving complex variables can give a selection of parameters that otherwise were completely free. For example, the value of the fluxes, right? And it also provides a probability distribution on solutions. And so we have this kind of picture here where we have a phase here where there's a negative potential and there's no solution. Going into a nice and medium one where there's a no boundary solution and stable internal dimensions, and then a higher one where there's no boundary solution but with the higher dimensions, extra dimensions are decompactifying. So clearly in this picture, you want to be in the parametric range is in the middle. And it, in fact, there's a selection. So this is the sense in which cosmology can act as a filter on the landscape and significantly reducing the number of viable solutions. Actually, there's another paper recently that Jean-Luc had written where he looks at the number of n-fold expansions and finds that actually, with this basically the same kind of argumentation involving this Concevich-Siegel limitation on allowable metrics, the number of n-folds turns out to be about 60, which happens to be what people like as the number. And that's not just a preference now, it's actually coming out of these probabilities. And moreover, it tells you how big the universe is now. If you follow that line of argument, the universe, it's a kind of a Alice in Wonderland universe. It's just big enough and not too big. It's a little bit, it's an order of 10 or so magnitude larger than the current horizon size, which obviously invites interesting possibilities for observation. So this is all I really wanted to tell you about. Thanks for, you know, for listening to me. But this seemed to me a couple of instances where maybe there are possibilities of overlaps between the kind of strictly mathematical stuff that actually I do when I go home and some of the observational material and hopefully other topics that we've been talking about in this conference. And in particular, we sort of have friends in the safe gravity community, and it would be nice if we could actually marry them up with string theory. Anyway, thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Kelly. Other questions?
Thank you for the nice talk. So, you mentioned that the KS criterion constrains the inflaton potential V prime over V is less than order one, right? Now, on the other hand, Swampland is exactly the opposite of that, the Swampland conjecture.
Ah, Swampland, yeah.
So, I take it that these are both insights from quantum gravity about effective field theory. So, how do you reconcile this?
I just want to mention also the paper I just talked about at the end, Jean-Luc's paper, where he says a small universe. He also is happy that it's fitting nicely into the Swampland parameters as well. So there is some sort of harmony that's possibly coming out of these discussions.
But how is it consistent with Swampland if they predict a different inequality?
I'm not trying to do real cosmology here, right? I mean, this is toy cosmology to me. It's just to show ways in which such things as parameter ranges can emerge. If you want to do a real full-dress job of the actual world, we should sit down and try and do it more seriously. That was starting from this eight-dimensional model, which is just to see a mechanism where you can include a potential for the you can include the form fields. So that's really all I can say about that. That's what they're designed for, I see, okay.
Thank you very much for the nice talk. I had a question concerning your second to last slide. So 37, where you write in the heading, the evolution to real time and fields. So what would be the interpretation of having, well, evolution in which parameter actually? So I can understand if I'm if I have a Euclidean time, then this would correspond to some kind of tunneling. And then in the...
Well, it is a tunneling, yes, it is. I mean, first of all, what it is, of course, where do these things come from? They are paths calculated numerically, but using the saddle point approximations. Given a saddle point, what path gets you there? And that's where these calculations, but for a variety of parametric ranges.
Okay, and what does it mean if this dark line is now not horizontal or vertical, but has
well,
some
finite
slope?
Far as, so there's there are two stories here, one for the scalar and one for the scale factor. Right, the scale factor here is not varying very much at all in terms of Minkowski time at the very beginning, but this is tick 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 in the Euclidean time until it starts here, right, and then it switches and Euclidean Minkowski time switches on. At the same time, the scalar is evolving along its trajectory. So that it is that curve in complex time that we were discussing, you know, in the corresponding values of the fields. So what I mean by evolution, right? This is an instanton. It is a tunneling phenomenon, but with the complexified time. I mean, you had it in the Hartle-Hawking picture too. What are you going to make? How are you going to interpret this lower world? Right, it's a two-dimensional hemi-four-sphere. Well, yeah, because that's true, right? But it sort of switched entirely from Euclidean to Minkowskian at the belt, whereas this, in fact, these calculations show that it happens more smoothly, which is, I think, what you would hope for.
So at this point, we thank Kelly again.